Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our deputy editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And this week, we'll be hearing from the director of Deadpool and Wolverine, Sean Levy, as well as stars Emma Corrin and Rob Delaney. Plus, me and Jordan will be reviewing that film, as well as the atmospheric mystery movie I Saw the TV Glow, slow burn drama about dry grasses, and TV reboot Time Bandits. But before we get onto that, Jordan, have you been watching anything else this week?
Yes, so I binge watched an Apple TV Plus series which recently wrapped called Dark Matter, which is somewhat pertinent to the conversation we're about to have today because it's a multiverse story, another multiverse story featuring variants, but no superheroes because Joel Edgerton and Jennifer Connelly, who star, they're playing pretty ordinary people, just very smart people. Edgerton in particular, he plays a teacher and a sort of former scientist who is, in the first episode, abducted from his universe by another version of him from a different universe, who has created this box which allows him to travel between worlds. As that probably sounds, this is much darker, much more adult, sort of much more cerebral in terms of wrestling with the concept of being able to navigate a multiverse. It has a very slow start, I will just warn you. I found the first two episodes, which are just pure setup, pretty tough going. But once it started exploring the concept, I was hooked and found it pretty engaging and pretty satisfying right to the end. So that's a big recommend from me if you don't mind sitting through 2 hours of not much happening before it gets good.
I really must pick up on that because I've already sat through the first 2 hours, which I actually quite enjoyed. But just as is often the case for me, I just haven't got around to actually finishing it yet. But
yeah, it gets a lot better. I'd say you didn't really need quite as much groundwork. but once it gets to the point where they are actually traveling through the multiverse, which I actually think is something that the Marvel films just haven't really explored enough because... Mm. Obviously, there have been plenty of multiverse films, but what typically ends up happening in their films is that they go to one new world and then they just stay there and then things come to them, essentially. Whereas in this, the idea is they stay constant, but they're traveling through all the different worlds and seeing how they're different and trying to get back to their original universe, which I did think offered something a little bit of a different perspective on a multiverse story.
Yeah, I've said this before, but I'm like a real sucker for multiverse stories as well. When explored in that kind of way, you know, that sort of how things could have been different. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, I haven't watched loads. Like, I've watched one thing which is under embargo, but it's not under social embargo, which I always find is a bit of a grey area, but it was Harold and the Purple Crayon. So it's that weird thing that I can't actually review it yet, but I could tweet my thoughts on it if I wished. So
you can
I
give us
know.
A tweet length reaction, but no more.
But yes, I won't really say too much about that. But yes, that's coming out next week. And I feel in a blind spot in my Disney animation history, which was The Black Cauldron, which I'd never seen that before. It was just randomly selected by my children to watch. And it was sort of interesting, like kind of striking in a lot of ways. But I mean, I can't say I loved it. And I found the voice acting quite grating. It was from that era in the 80s where there was often just, I don't know, found the voice acting just quite unpleasant to listen to. But you know, are you a fan of that one? Was that one that was on rotation?
I haven't seen it, to be honest. Oh, okay. No, so... I need to fill in the blank as well. Yeah, but speaking of children, my quite young daughter recently sat through her first film from start to finish.
Oh wow.
Which was Wall-E.
Nice.
Which I was very happy with. She's got incredible taste. And obviously now, this was about 5 days ago now, and she's now sat through it about 50 times, of course, because she just absolutely loves it. But man, that is an unbelievably good film. Like, I've watched it at least a dozen times in the last few days. And the whole thing is just remarkable. It's so well done. I was just sort of blown away by just how good it was, even though it is probably my favorite Pixar film. I'd almost forgotten just how exceptional it is. And oh man, it's so good. Just so much personality in that little guy. And so moving.
It's great.
Makes me well up every time.
Yeah. And that's where you can really test films, when you watch them with kids and you watch them again and again. And you just so thoroughly kind of analyze and know the nuts and bolts of it. And like, I had it once with a Paddington episode, and it was like Paddington and the Chores List, for anyone who's ever watched the sort of the new animated series with Ben Whishaw's voice. And I literally watched that episode, you know, several times a day for I can't even tell you how long. It just
Yeah.
after just so many viewings, I felt like I was sort of seeing it, you know, as Neo would see it or something, you know. And
Seeing the code, you're in the fourth dimensional bookcase of that episode.
but yes, okay, so interesting child orientated viewing this week anyway. But now let's get on to this week's new releases. And first up, it's time for this year's only MCU movie.
Whoever you think I am, you got the wrong guy.
You were always the wrong guy. Till you weren't.
Are you ready? Yeah, I'm ready. I'm the Wolverine. Stop it.
This is Deadpool and Wolverine, which is effectively Deadpool 3, but it's also more than that, as this is the film that is finally going to bring Ryan Reynolds' Merc with a Mouth under the umbrella of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, following the merger of Disney and Fox a few years back. And as the title suggests, this film involves Deadpool teaming up with Hugh Jackman's Logan, or at least a variation of the character we've known so far, and going on a timeline-saving mission. But before we review this film, we're going to hear from some of the people involved in the making of it, starting with the film's director, Shawn Levy, followed by Emma Corrin, who plays the new villain of the piece, Cassandra Nova, and Rob Delaney, who returns as Wade's pal, Peter. Amy West caught up with them recently, and here's what they had to say.
In my world, you're well regarded.
You were an X-Man. You were the X-Man. Wolverine is a hero in my world.
Yeah, well, he ain't mine.
So this obviously ties in with Loki in a big way, and I think I'm safe to say that there's a Doctor Strange portal in the trailer. How much homework did you have to do before you started work on it?
I had to do some. I won't claim that I had complete fluency, but I'd already watched some of Loki and really enjoyed it, but when we knew we had Hugh and we knew we had Wolverine, we also knew that Hugh Ryan and I have a shared reverence for Logan. We have tremendous respect for that masterpiece of a movie. So you start thinking, okay, well, we're not going to mess with that legacy. And yet Hugh wants in. How can we access Wolverine in a different way? And so the existence of the TVA, the way that it's already been set up via Loki, gave us huge opportunities, and then specifically one episode in season one of Loki, which takes those characters to the void. That sets up a whole other dimension that was very useful to us and our story.
And how do you balance the meta and the movie? Obviously, you've got to have the jokes in there because it's Deadpool, but then you still have to make sure that there are stakes and emotion. And also with timeline stuff, you know, to have those stakes. It can't just be like, well, we can just do a do-over on the timeline.
Well, for starters, you do have to have respect for what's come before. And even if we might occasionally be tempted to be lazy or dismissive of it, this is earned adoration and connection with a global fan base. So that has to be treated with respect. And also, we have to treat the story with respect. And so given that we always knew the opportunity here was these two characters co-starring in a movie for the first time ever, we knew, and Ryan and I were very cognizant of this, it's something we talked about a lot, if the frequency of meta jokes gets too high, there's no way the audience is going to hook in and invest in the story. So we would often pull self-referential jokes out of the movie so that we got the cadence and the titration of that just right.
How do you wrap your head around the fact that Deadpool is referencing Paul Rudd, but then Cap exists? So it's like, how can Ant-Man be real and then mention Paul Rudd?
I feel like you could take us down a dark alleyway of questioning that neither one of us would survive. We would get brutally mugged and beat up in this alleyway. I have to say, along with Kevin Feige and Wendy Jacobson and Lou Diaz-Pedro at Marvel, Ryan and me and the other co-writers, we spent a lot of time thinking about this. And if you had asked me, there's a few other questions that I cannot wait to get fed on social media once the movie is out that I have answers for. I'm so ready. And I've got that logic watertight. But I feel like you're leading me into an area where it's a little bit of a leaky boat, but hopefully just like a little delightful wading pool worth of water and not a sinking ship.
So the movie really isn't afraid to kind of take pops at Marvel. Were you ever sort of nervous to push it that far?
Honestly, yes. I presumed that someone would make us stop every time we turned in a draft of our script or every time we turned in a new cut of the movie. Ryan and I would kind of sit back waiting for what we thought would be the inevitable pushback, and it never came. And what we realized is that the law of the land on this movie with Kevin Feige, who knew what he was signing up for, is if it's funny, it sticks. If it's not funny, then let's talk about the merits on a comedic basis. But it really was anything goes. And the creative freedom that Marvel gave us was, frankly, a little shocking, but also completely thrilling.
And speaking of jokes, a lot of fans sort of say they'd love to see Wade's pansexuality kind of expressed or even explored in a way that's kind of not a gag or like a kind of a throwaway line. He's technically single now, and Wolverine is right there. Is there scope for that in this film or future movies, do you think?
What I think is clear is that Wade's heart belongs to Vanessa. Wade's heart will likely always belong to Vanessa. And even though we meet Wade and Vanessa at a different point in their relationship in Deadpool and Wolverine, there is a profound devotion to her that I think it supersedes all the rest. So Wade is a flirt. Wade is indeed open to attraction anywhere. But the Wolverine Deadpool story is, I think, one of friendship, one of brotherhood, and really a redemptive connection that doesn't bring sexual tension onto the table.
This is obviously Hugh's 10th time playing Wolverine. What's kind of new this time around? What did he bring to this that you hadn't seen before?
Well, I think it was reciprocal. Hugh brought something, we brought something as writers. Hugh brought his 55 years. Hugh brought his soul and gravitas and wisdom and heart from having lived this many years and having been Wolverine this long. So there is you even see it in some of the shots in the trailer when he's in that white t-shirt. So many fans have found me online and pointed out that one shot. It's 1 second long. But you see a haunted man who's wrestling with something. So Hugh brought a depth of feeling and experience that is unlike anything I've seen in the other movies. Our job was to give him some meat to chew on in the form of scenes that we wrote specifically so that Hugh could tear it up and explore a Logan who's still very much the character we love, but maybe less silent, maybe a little less laconic, a little less distant. And as a result, it's probably, and Hugh said this, a more verbal Logan. And the challenge was writing Logan scenes with words that Hugh can say, but don't betray the character that we all adore.
And you've got these two iconic, beloved heroes at the center of this, but they say that a hero is only as good as their villain. Why Cassandra Nova as the film's villain?
We love that Cassandra Nova, A, has never been represented on screen. B, is very powerful as an Omega-level mutant. So just massive abilities and power. And we also liked her connection to her brother, Charles Xavier, because this movie definitely explores the legacy of the Fox Marvel era and the fact that this MCU villain is connected to this Fox Marvel hero is very rich and opened up some cool areas for story.
As a big Stranger Things fan, I have to kind of ask about it. Ross Duffer kind of said that they were halfway through filming. Have you had a chance to reunite with that, and what has that been like?
I have reunited because the building where we film Hawkins Lab was about to be torn down. So I had to leave the edit room of Deadpool and Wolverine, go to Atlanta, film a chunk of my work for season 5 before the building didn't exist. So I toe dipped then, but literally 5 days after this movie comes out, I will be back in Hawkins directing a chunk of season 5.
So I'll start with saying, how did this role find you? And was doing a superhero movie something you kind of always envisioned for yourself, or did it just kind of happen?
No, it wasn't a call I was expecting. And then, yeah, when it came in, I was so surprised and really overjoyed because I'd been looking to do something that would be a bit more of a challenge, a bit more different. And yeah, Sean really delivered on that. And it's an amazing ensemble and story to join.
Like your past work, so Diana and Darcy are really understated and very sort of internal. Cassandra, from what I've seen, looks very theatrical and she's really like enjoying messing with people. What was that like for you to embrace that kind of otherworldly big performance?
Well, you know what? It was actually kind of the opposite. Yeah, something Sean and Ryan said quite early on to me was that they wanted Cassandra to be not what you'd expect from a villain. Mm-hmm. They wanted her to be quite low-key and not appear villainous, as to sort of always keep people guessing and never be quite sure about what you're going to get. And in that way, also with her powers of telepathy, there was quite a strong internal world, which I guess was something which I was quite familiar with, but this is sort of taking that and planting it in a whole new setting with a whole new host of challenges. And then, of course, there was all the gesture and the physicality, which was really interesting to try and link that to her internal world and sort of join the whole thing together.
And you said about like her fitting into the world. Her comic book history is dark, but the Deadpool films, they're kind of like straight up comedies in places. How did you work with Sean to make sure that she fit into that kind of tone?
I think that's one of the biggest things I've learned from this film, and you know, getting to know Sean really well and Ryan and watch their process crafting this film. Nothing's set in stone with Deadpool ever. You know, there's a script, but then stuff changes because Ryan and Sean are always throwing ideas in, and it's always a shifting thing, but then there's always a balance of tone to bring into it. I think you get the sense in this film that Cassandra can go to the places that you see in the comics. She can be that dark, but Cassandra chooses very specifically if and when she wants to use her power. She knows she's so powerful and she's so confident in that that she doesn't need to prove it. Like, you've got these two anti-heroes, Deadpool, Wolverine, that wear their power very openly and very on the front foot, and Cassandra's very much not. And I think there's a real power in that, and that was fun.
What can you kind of tease about her motives without getting into spoilers?
When you're playing a villain, I think it's quite hard to find the emotional hook into like why they're doing what they're doing. What is their motivation? Looking back at her origin story and her relationship with her brother and all the feelings that his actions towards her would cause her now, I think that's where I found a lot of motivation for her actions, whether it's out of revenge or self-hatred or a cry for his attention, a feeling that she'll never be good enough for him or as good as him. And so the only option is to be sort of the worst version of herself.
Did you look at any existing sort of bad guys in films or anything for inspiration, or not really?
Yeah, sort of Ryan came in with the reference of Christoph Waltz's character, Hans Lander, in Inglourious Basterds, which is a fantastic film and a fantastic performance. And there is that sort of stillness and calmness to that evil, and that makes it really insidious. Going along that line, I sort of ended up looking at Gene Wilder in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, because even though he's not, you know, known as a villain, I think there's something quite off-kilter and uncanny and a bit sinister to the way that he invites all these people here and then sort of steps back and watches it all unfold with a sort of slight smile on his face. That takes a real inner confidence and calm. And that was interesting to find.
What was it like working with Ryan and Hugh, and did they give you any specific advice about joining this kind of world that stuck with you?
Well, it was nice to chat to Hugh and know that even like 24 years into playing this role, he still increasingly feels the pressure and still feels anxious, and you know, he wants to do a good job, and I certainly felt that coming into this world, this universe. But it was amazing. They're two of the nicest guys I've worked with, and they just made me feel very welcome in an environment that could have made me feel very overwhelmed.
And you kind of mentioned the physicality of Cassandra, and obviously her look is lifted straight out of the comics. How important was that look for you to get into character? And was there any talk of maybe making her look different than the comics, or was it always kind of strict?
No, there was freedom. I think Sean was very open to things to be different from the comics. And I know there were several conversations around costume, whether we should go further away. I remember when I first saw one of the costume boards, there were quite large departures from it, things that were exactly like it, and I think we landed somewhere in the middle.
You said in a previous interview that Deadpool and Wolverine has kind of the most heart of any superhero movie, which is quite a big statement.
Yeah, especially coming from someone who hasn't watched any of them.
Well, can you kind of elaborate on that a little bit? What did you mean by that in terms of this specific film?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't know if it has the most heart of any superhero movie, but certainly, being new to this world, I was surprised at the amount of heart that this film has. It's a film at its core about friendship, and it's really moving. Yeah, I think that is going to surprise people.
From one bald baddie with creepy fingers to another, you're going to be seen in Nosferatu at the end of the year. I'm super excited about that one. What was that like to be a part of?
Amazing. I mean, Robert Eggers is a total genius and a real artist. He puts together these incredible ensembles of actors. And then no matter what part you're playing, and you just really feel like, yeah, it's a real group effort and it's a beautiful thing to be a part of.
How does it feel being one of the few members of the X-Force being brought back into the third film?
Well, really wonderful. I suppose they wouldn't have brought Peter back if people didn't enjoy watching Peter, so that feels good. So, yeah, I just feel grateful.
How is he adjusting to kind of resurrected life? Does he feel like he has kind of been brought back from the dead?
The stuff in this film takes place a little afterwards, so he's kind of settled into a sort of more quotidian, normal life with Wade alongside him. You know, they're friends, and they go for bike rides together, and they work together selling used cars. He knows Deadpool should be doing more with his skills, but he's very happy to be getting to hang out with him.
And he's got some interesting jewelry in this film. Can you talk a bit about that?
I can't elaborate on his interesting jewelry, but I will say, you know, when you see it, the whole theater will, not just the front few rows, but the whole theater will be a splash zone.
How has his relationship with Wade changed since the second film?
Well, he's gotten to know him better, gotten to know what makes him tick, you know, and I think really has learned what a good person, you know, what a kind heart, in fact, beats inside of him. So, yeah, he's seen deeper into Wade.
And how does Peter's presence keep the heart in Deadpool 3 along with the rest of Wade's found family?
I think it's very obvious that Peter really has Wade's back and has his best interests at heart. Yeah, he's sort of, I don't know, what would you call him, like a valet? You know, he's like his man-sistant or something, who just wants to help him, you know, execute what he's supposed to do.
For someone making them, how different did a Marvel Deadpool production feel to a Fox Deadpool production, or did it not feel that different to you?
There were similarities, but it absolutely felt bigger. You know, I mean, there were sets, for example, in this one where I was like, my jaw dropped, you know. So it did feel bigger, but at the same time, you know, you felt Ryan and Sean's control over the story that they wanted to tell and the caring and also the flexibility and the ability to react to things as they were happening in real time and adjust. So the same, but also very different.
What's it like working with Ryan? I mean, everyone's sort of saying he never runs out of ideas and he's always got energy on set.
Yeah, he's very funny. I mean, for me, because like I write stuff, I do stand up, and I am always impressed by Ryan's comic mind, you know? So, I mean, to me, people might not say like, oh, Ryan Reynolds, the writer, but I do, because his ideas are so good, you know, and his turn of phrase and his sense of story. So for me, it's just really fun and educational and a privilege to get to just watch how the sausage is made.
The trailers for this movie is, they've been really keeping their cards very close to their chests in terms of secrets, cameos, all that kind of thing. What's the wildest thing that you saw Marvel do to keep things from leaking?
We shot this at Pinewood in London, which is one of the greatest studios in the world. So for me, I didn't have to leave the studio. So I didn't have to sort of witness any crazy set precautions. I was given a short speech by like a Marvel security person about like how to like live my life in a way that didn't like release secrets inadvertently and stuff. That was kind of funny. I was like, okay, yeah, all right. On Deadpool 2, I did have to wear a black cloak when we shot on location, meaning not in a studio, just like out in the world. So that people couldn't see my costume, which was...
I love that because it's just normal clothes.
Exactly. In fact, so there were people who should have been wearing cloaks, and I remember being like, my costume is just normal clothes. I don't need to wear a cloak, do I? And they were like, put on the cloak. And I was like, okay.
And will we ever get to see Peter get powers? Because so many heroes start off as normal people, so, you know, it could happen.
Gosh, I hope not. You know, I think that would be cheap. I think Peter should have to work with what he's got. Because with limitations, you can discover special skills, you know, that might not be magical, but you might be able to do something that other people couldn't do because they're relying too hard on their powers. Look at me, I've got an adamantium skeleton. I mean, enough of that, right?
If Peter got a spin-off and could have a kind of Deadpool and Wolverine style team up with someone, which hero would you pick and what genre would you want it to be?
I just rewatched Out of Sight with George Clooney and Jennifer Lopez, and that movie's so good. So maybe he could like rob banks using the power of kindness with George Clooney's character in that. That's just what immediately came to mind. But he would tell him, don't rob the bank. And then George Clooney would be like, I'm going to lock you in this case. It has air holes in it. You're not going to die, but you'll probably be in here for a week. And then he'd rob the bank and make love with Jennifer Lopez. And I could listen through the holes. So, I mean, I think that's a good pitch.
Anna, I wanted to talk to you about working with Sean. What is he like as a kind of co-writer and director? And what sort of guidance did he give you on the set?
Well, he's a really good director. And what I liked about him is he's not like, do it this way this time. He'll be like, what if you said it in a lower voice? Or like at the end, what if your voice went up? So he gets like the really oblique, like musical notes that are really fun because they just open your mind in a different way. So he's very generous and sort of doesn't tell you where to go, but gives you sort of put some wind in your sails to figure it out on your own. So really, really great. I remember texting him like after I wrapped being like, you're the best director of actors I've ever worked with. Whereas some of the action stuff, you know, you could use some help. Was that a backhanded compliment? Because I was like, you're the best director of actors. Yeah. But to act for him is great.
So that was Sean Levy, Emma Corrin and Rob Delaney on Deadpool and Wolverine. Jordan, do you want to set this one up a bit further for us?
Yeah, as you sort of expanded on in your introduction there, this is the third Deadpool film, which they do actually refer to as a threequel within the movie in that sort of fourth wall meta way, but does feel quite distinct from the first two in insignificant ways. Yeah, the most significant ones being that it's a sort of reluctant buddy movie co-starring a never-before-seen variant of Hugh Jackman's Wolverine, and of course the not insignificant fact that Deadpool is now a part of the MCU, the all-conquering comic book universe. So it starts roughly in the present day, sort of 6 years after the events of Deadpool 2. We learned that Deadpool has unsuccessfully tried to sign up for the Avengers, and since then he's become a used car salesman and hung up the spandex until one day he gets a knock at the door, and it's the TVA, who anyone who is up to speed on their MCU storytelling will know that the TVA appeared in Loki, most notably. And the person who's called on Deadpool is Matthew McFadden's Mr. Paradox, who tells Wade Wilson that his world is dying following the death of the world's anchor being, that anchor being Logan, Hugh Jackman's Logan, who died, of course, in the movie Logan. So in order to save his world, Deadpool thinks he has to find a new Logan, but gets himself pruned for his troubles and sent to the void. So at this stage, the bulk of the film essentially is Deadpool and Wolverine in the void from Loki season 1, episode 5, which I only remember because Deadpool helpfully reminds you in the film. And they're essentially trying to survive this Mad Max parodying wasteland ruled over by Emma Corrin's Cassandra Nova, who is a very powerful telepath, telekinetic. And if you don't know your comic book lore, she is the twin sister of Charles Xavier, who is very angry that she's been abandoned and left in this dead world. I don't want to say too much more than that, because then you start to delve into spoiler territory. But there are many things to recommend in this beyond, you know, the surprises and the cameos, which do come and are very surprising and very exciting. The thing that worked best for me was this antagonistic buddy dynamic between Deadpool and Wolverine. As we're told many, many times, this is the worst Wolverine. He's the one who feels completely responsible for the death of every mutant in his world. He lives at the bottom of a bottle. He absolutely hates Deadpool when he first meets him. They get in several extremely brutal fights, including one which takes place almost entirely inside a people carrier, which is very
Honda
funny.
Odyssey, I believe it was.
Honda Odyssey, yeah. That's it. They do make a joke about it, a very long joke about it, which is very creatively staged. And obviously Reynolds and Hugh Jackman and I imagine their stunt doubles put a lot of work and effort into making that sequence as impactful as it is. Jackman's Logan has a lot going on himself. He feels responsible for some terrible event in his world, which as they tease, you're going to learn about in a third act flashback. And the fact that he is on a path of redemption is adds a bit of gravitas and a bit of weight to the film, I think. And gives it some personal stakes, which balance out the sort of, you know, the timeline obliterating mega stakes, which are also going on in the film. I had mixed feelings about it in the sense that, if you'll excuse this cheeky plug, I did an M. Night Shyamalan interview for our new issue where
check it out
on sale now, where he talks about this idea of a sugar quotient versus a resonance quotient is how he framed it. And in that interview, he's talking about the character David Dunn's very ignoble fate in the movie Glass. And he justifies it by saying it's a storytelling choice that doesn't give you that instant sugar rush that very quickly fades, but it's something that sort of resonates and sticks with you. And he's not wrong in the sense that I've thought about David Dunn's end in that film quite a lot. I mean, I didn't like his end, but it's something that I kind of come back to every so often. But watching Deadpool and Wolverine, I couldn't help but think that this is just 100% sugar, essentially, with absolutely no resonance, because I can feel that I'm really enjoying it in the moment. And there are like big surprises and really fun people do turn up. And just because, again, the gag rate is sort of so high and the knowing humor, the fourth wall breaking humor makes you feel like you're part of the club and you're in on the joke. But now I sort of know what the secrets are and what the surprises are and how far they were willing to go with the gags. I'm not sure that this film has anything to offer from repeat viewings, which I don't know if that's harsh, because I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing, even, because the vast majority of films I've watched in my life, I have and probably will only ever watch once. But it's sort of also how long it lives in the memory and how much it resonates. So yeah, I had sort of mixed feelings in the sense that I enjoyed it in the moment, but is it going to stand the test of time? I'm not sure.
It's interesting because there, you and Knight have very much touched upon something I wrestled with reviewing this film. So I reviewed it for Total Film, so you can read the full review online if you prefer reading to listening, or you want to just check that out as well. And I gave it 4 stars, and often you're kind of torn, you're sort of straddling a star rating sometimes, because there can feel like a big gulf between 3 and 4 sometimes, and there's so much to weigh up when it comes to actually, you know, anointing a film with a star rating. But a thing I really wrestled with is, for me, it was very much a 4 in the moment, because I actually did just really enjoy this film. I kind of went in not fully knowing what to expect. Obviously, the MCU hasn't been at its strongest for a while now, so there's a lot riding on this. It's the only film this year. I am always inherently a bit cynical about bringing back characters using the multiverse, like even when they did that with Loki. Like, there'll always be a part in the back of my mind that's like, come on, we've said goodbye to this character. Like, you tried to give us a, you know, an emotional goodbye to this character, and you are kind of cheating by bringing them back. So I always have those kind of things floating around my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, basically that was the kind of feeling I had, was that it was like a 4 in the moment and then probably a 3 long term, if you know what I mean. And then it's hard to say, because then it feels a bit harsh to say, oh, this is a 3-star film, when I did have a great time with it at the cinema, and I feel like plenty of others will do as well. I mean, it's a classic case of the film that if you don't think you'll like this, and if you haven't enjoyed the previous Deadpool films and, you know, the MCU in general, it's not going to convert you, and you're not going to suddenly be on board and going to change your mind about everything. But I feel like it's a very enjoyable film if you are on board, if you like that stuff, if you like Deadpool's humor, if you like sort of over the top action, and if you like all these callbacks. And obviously as well, so much of the fun of that first viewing is that, you know, again, we won't go into any details here, but there are just some really nice surprises and moments and things that, just even though the trailers have given away a lot, there's still things that are really pleasant surprises when you actually see them in the film. It just genuinely, I found it exciting to watch. I found it a real sort of thrill in a lot of places. But then, obviously, I mean, I've only seen it once at this point, so I can't say this for sure, but I feel like when you watch it again and you've already had those surprises, that it's obviously a kind of a lesser film. And as you kind of hinted at with the whole sugar quotient thing, yeah, I don't feel like there's loads going on under the surface. And I also feel as well, it's so many things with these kind of films that are tricky to discuss without going into, without sort of spoiling it for anyone who hasn't seen it yet. And I really feel like the review, if you want to read that, I really felt like I avoided spoilers there, because I just don't really, I personally hate reading spoilers in reviews before I've seen a film. But yeah, there's so many things that are difficult to talk about without kind of at least hinting at spoilers. But one of the things being that this didn't feel as much of an MCU movie as I was expecting, in the sense that obviously the vast amount of time is spent in the void. So obviously it has this connection to the MCU, but it's almost like an adjacent part of the MCU rather than the, you know, the full 616 timeline. So there's that element that it didn't go as far there as I thought. And there were certain things you wonder if they could have pushed further with it, again, without going into too much detail. But there are a few plot threads that are left untied up, which, again, you presume, as is the Marvel way, they're going to plan to connect the dots in some somewhere in the future. But there's a few things that are weirdly left untied up. And strangely as well, and in a way which I actually thought worked on the whole, really, especially on this whole meta level that you get with Deadpool. But it's kind of like a farewell to the Fox movies in a way. That's in some ways, which sort of surprised me almost, but that's how it seemingly functions, rather than so much an introduction into the MCU. It's almost like a farewell to the Fox universe, but then not quite everything added up there. I didn't think, like, again, more in hindsight, really, for me, I suppose, again, that you get this with films sometimes where you really enjoy it in the moment. And then the more you think about it afterwards, the more you're kind of like, what was going on there?
I had sort of two thoughts about this idea that it's a sort of eulogy for the Fox movies. Mm. The main one is, you know, it's not a huge spoiler to say that there are like characters from the Fox universe of films that appear in this.
You see them in the trailers,
Yeah, exactly. Aaron Stanford's Pyro is featured in the trailer, obviously. I did get a slight sense that the people that do appear in this were just sort of the people that they could get hold of. It just seemed like a random selection of people that they decided to actually feature. And I wasn't really sure why they picked those over some others, for example. So it just felt like they sort of got who they got. And some of them are like very exciting and cool. And it's great to see them sort of back on screen. The other thing is that obviously there's this big debate around Marvel movies at the moment around sort of the idea of homework and how much you have to know going into each film to truly appreciate what they're doing. And I just felt like, you know, this sort of exploded around Infinity War and Endgame, where, you know, the question was, do you have to have seen 20 plus films to understand what's going on in these films? And with this one, I thought it almost took it to another extreme, in the sense that not only did you sort of have to be up to speed on like the MCU to date, including TV shows, you also had to be up to date with every sort of Fox universe movie, plus like unmade Fox universe movies, which is just sort of insane for like an average person at the cinema. Mm. Like, is everyone going to get all this stuff? Probably not. It probably works on one level, even if you don't exactly get what the joke is. But if you're in deep on all this stuff, then you'll appreciate it all the more. Mm. But this really did just feel like a huge one for the fans more than anything.
And that is, and that's another thing that makes it tricky to sort of evaluate a film like this, because for me, I'm all in on that. And I love
exactly.
All those references, I love any of the jokes where they joke about the structure and things like that, when there's jokes about intimacy coordinators and dialogue coaches and things like that. And obviously I, you know, just have followed this world and everything surrounding it, like you say, from the beginning. But I'm really intrigued for, like, I mean, it sounds bad to say this, but I always use my wife as a sort of yardstick for the sort of the average person seeing a film, because she will kind of watch anything that I recommend, but she never really will follow the stories outside of a film like I do. So she will go in without any sort of prior knowledge of what's expected to happen because of the comics, or, you know, all this kind of backstory you might have. So I'd be very intrigued to see how some of the things play to her. I still think there's elements that will just be fun regardless, because of just how they're done. But they just won't mean the same to people if you haven't invested in the world that the way that this film obviously expects you to. Which again is a tricky thing, because, like I say, ultimately, I think if you don't like these movies, you're not going to be going to see Deadpool and Wolverine, are you? Like, if it just doesn't sound like your cup of tea. And maybe I'm wrong. Please write in if you do. You know of people who just really fancy it, having not seen any of the previous films or not been up to date. But I mean, I suppose there is that possibility that you've just watched the Deadpool movies and you come into this. That would be quite a lot to take in, I think. But to go on the positives, I would say, because again, like I say, it's one of those films that in some ways it's easier to think of the negatives afterwards, despite the fact that I actually really did enjoy it. But on the positives, I thought Shawn Levy did a really good job, in the sense of, I actually felt there was some like heart to this, which you don't necessarily, I mean, there's always been a little bit of it in the Deadpool movies maybe, but this has the most, and combined with Hugh Jackman, just to me, just bringing so much more than he kind of had any right to this film, when he's already had his big goodbye moment with Logan, already sort of said farewell to the character in a very special way. But he just has so much gravitas, and I just absolutely love him as this character. And it so could have just been a cheap cynical cash in having him back. Arguably, you can say it still is that, but he doesn't sort of treat it in that way, I don't think. And he sort of brings so much more to it.
Yeah, again, he brings his A game, definitely. Yeah.
So to me, he was the MVP, and I've always like since the first X-Men, you know, I just loved him as that character. And it's that thing that I'm guilty of, that sugar, it's the sugar thing again, but I'm guilty of, like, you kind of want that, and then afterwards you have that sugar crash and you're like, oh, has that kind of cheapened Logan somewhat? That we've just had another adventure with a very similar, albeit variant, of Wolverine. But I just enjoyed it. I just enjoyed having him back. Of course, again, for a certain type of geek, there's just that thrill of just seeing him in the classic yellow costume. And there's other kind of moments like that as well, which just thrill the geeks. And yeah, and I thought the action for the most part was really nicely done here. I thought there was some really nicely choreographed and fun kind of action scenes. So I thought it was a very slick film in that sense. And then Emma Corrin doesn't get a huge amount of screen time here, as we've kind of hinted at. There's a lot going on, but I did think they actually made a sort of impressive impact in the time that they were on screen. I actually thought, again, it has been a weakness of some of the Marvel films in the past, the villain, but I thought Cassandra was like an interesting character, and yeah, did basically make that impact despite not having loads of screen time. And has some interesting powers, and I liked what they did with that character.
They do mind reading in a very gnarly and memorable way. I'll give them that.
Yeah, so I like that element, and it goes a bit sort of traditional with the superhero ending. But one of the things I also liked about it, again, that I kind of put down to Sean Levy, but obviously I can't necessarily give him all credit for this, but you feel like it's maybe something that he brought based on the films he's made previously, especially the ones he's done with Ryan Reynolds, Free Guy and The Adam Project. But like I say, there was the heart, and then I did feel like I felt the stakes in this one, because they make it very much about Deadpool. He's trying to save his timeline because of these friends he's got in his timeline. And so I did actually feel like there was that kind of sense of personal stakes that you don't always get. And while obviously in a sense there is an entire timeline at stake here, you just feel it that he's basically trying to protect his friends. So I thought, compared to how a lot of these superhero movies, again, they end up with just such huge, you know, world-ending stakes that you just can't really get your head around, I thought that did a nice job of making it feel like there were actually stakes here. Yeah, so I liked that. I liked that element as well. Matthew McFadden was very enjoyable, I thought, as well. Kind of fun if you've enjoyed him in Succession as Tom.
Yeah, he's basically playing Tom Wobbskamp.
He's like a Tom variant, isn't he?
Exactly, yeah. But he's wearing the same clothes and everything.
Yeah, I enjoyed him a lot. And again, this was one of those films that, for me, not every joke landed. And particularly for a UK audience, there are quite a lot of US pop culture references. But there's so many gags and so many I actually just genuinely did laugh out loud at that.
Yeah,
it was a very funny film. And that's why I think overall, I feel like it is a film you get your bang for your buck for when you go to the cinema to see this. Whether you'll revisit in years to come, you won't. And again, without going into spoilers, one thing about it is it's kind of seen as this big moment for the MCU because of the stage everything's in, and it having this kind of tricky time, this providing some kind of reset for it, and obviously introducing this character. But it doesn't really sort of, you know, move the needle on the MCU particularly at all after this. And obviously you've got to stay for the credits, but they make quite an unusual choice for the, you know, kind of what you could describe as mid credits. And then there is an end credits to stay around for, but it's a fun gag. Basically, it's not, it's nothing like, you know, setting up what's really going to be happening next. So again, it feels like a fun moment, but perhaps not the game changer that people might have expected.
Only a game changer in the sense that it is just like really fun. And I'm not saying films like The Marvels, for example, which is, you know, Marvel's most notorious failure to date. I'm not saying that wasn't fun, but I can see just audiences responding to this and being more on board with it than they were with that film, for example. So in that sense, it feels like audiences at large, I think, will just be much more invested in the MCU again after this. So it could feel like a bit of a turning point going into Captain America Brave New World, which is the next big screen MCU story. But overall, like great fun, like really funny, very entertaining. But I question whether it will be holding it up as, you know, one of the great MCU movies in the years to come. I sort of doubt it.
So that was Deadpool and Wolverine, which is in cinemas now. And next up, it's time for a woozy sort of horror about a TV obsession and much more.
I know this might sound crazy. I don't want to alarm you, Do you remember a TV show we used to watch together? It was called...
The Big O' Big?
Yeah. Do you watch?
So, this is I Saw the TV Glow. Jordan, do you want to set this one up for us?
Yeah, this is the latest film from Jane Schoenbrunn, who is best known for making a very trippy film called We're All Going to the World's Fair a few years ago. It stars Justice Smith of Detective Pikachu and Jurassic World fame, and Bridget Lundy Payne, who movie fans will know best as Ted's daughter in Bill and Ted Face the Music. They are teenagers with a couple of years between them, but a shared obsession with a Buffy-style series called The Pink Opaque, which is about these two young women who live on opposite sides of their county, but who fight monsters of the week together through a sort of psychic connection. So very cheesy 90s, early aughts stuff. Smith's Owen isn't old enough to stay up and watch, so Maddie, who's played by Lundy Payne, she hides VHS tapes around school for him to pick up and watch so he can stay up to speed with the story. A couple of years pass, and Maddie tells Owen that they want to run away and they don't feel comfortable in their own home, and that Owen should go too. But Owen, he sort of chickens out and stays, and soon after he watches what turns out to be the last ever episode of The Pink Opaque, which ends on this incredibly sinister and bleak cliffhanger and this sort of strange metaphysical sort of way that causes Owen to have a breakdown. And again, years pass, and what becomes clear is that Owen and Maddie are more intricately connected to The Pink Opaque than either of them could have imagined, and it's a fact that's sort of tied to his own identity. And Schoenbrunn has gone on the record saying that this film is an allegory for the trans experience. It's tricky to explain why in any great detail, because I think you'd be spoiling some pretty late film plot twists by doing that. But what it isn't is a straightforward drama about a person transitioning. Is much more subtle and much more effective than that, because instead of sort of just showing you, it puts you in the headspace of someone who is uncomfortable in their own skin through this more fantastical conceit. And I thought that was actually really inspired and really clever. As a piece of filmmaking, I thought it was incredibly accomplished as well. It's sort of beautifully lit. It has this very otherworldly sort of Twin Peaksy vibe, where you get the sense it's not really in anything that resembles the real world, but there's something very stylized and heightened going on. Terrific performances. I thought Lundy Payne in particular was terrific, just very sort of charismatic, and has a sort of monologue moment which I found sort of gripping in its way. Very experimental as a piece of filmmaking, and not all of the swings pay off, I would say. There are sort of some devices that didn't work as well for me as others did, but thrillingly unique, very confident, very unsettling piece of work that I thought really did have something fairly powerful to say. What did you think, Matt?
Yeah, I largely agree with that, really, to be honest. I really, really enjoyed this. And I went into it, actually, I was aware of the sort of transgender analogy before going in. I knew that that was going to play into the film in some way. Yeah, like you say, it doesn't do it in an obvious way that just feels like a really sort of straightforward metaphor or anything like that. And it's one of those films that I think some people may struggle to get on board with, it because you've got to submit to its wavelength, really, and just go with it, because it is different, it is unusual. There's clearly a bit of a sort of David Lynch influence as well going on.
Yeah, big time.
And but there is this something. It was almost like just one of those films where from the off, I was just kind of captivated by it. And like, I was captivated by these two sort of outsider characters, and just there was something really charismatic in their performances, but in a really unusual way. I really sort of like fell for this bond between them, and the way they connect, and they're obviously both dealing with their own stuff and own sort of home issues. Yeah, so I just really kind of really sort of connected to them as characters. And then it's one of those films that you definitely kind of come away from it wondering if you dreamt certain things about it, because it just has that weird quality to it. And like the show, there's something weird about the show, and I've seen it called a horror film, and it definitely does have sort of kind of elements of horror and some freaky imagery and things like that. But it feels like a really hard one to classify in terms of genre for me, because it's certainly not a typical horror by any means. And I just also like loved the idea of just that obsession with a TV show and how it can kind of consume your life, how it can sort of, you know, feel more real to you than your own life, how it can connect you with friends, and, you know, how it can sort of set up those relationships in your life. And I also as well, I just love that idea of staying up late to watch something. It just takes you back to that era when things weren't just so readily available to watch. Yeah, there's something really, really intriguing about it. There's this character called Mr. Melancholy, that's this big moon face, Voyage dans la Lune type figure, a little bit Mighty Boosh, but much scarier. So there's weird images that get stuck in your mind. Like I say, left me thinking, how did I dream certain things? But yes, very, very compelling. And again, hard to say too much about, but without spoiling, but it goes into a weird way. And I just like that sort of blurring of reality and fiction that happens with this TV show.
Yeah, I love that. Did you watch Buffy or any of those films back in the day? Did you have that sort of experience that the characters do in this film?
Not so. I wasn't obsessive about Buffy. I watched the first couple of seasons of Buffy, but I didn't kind of obsessively watch the whole thing. But it just felt very familiar to me. I'm trying to think what it would have been for me, really, that was the thing I connected with that. But just the idea of, like, you know, getting books, like episode guides and things like that.
Yeah.
Again, I feel like we've lost that. We've lost that in the modern world.
I remember being obsessed with shows and just pouring through books like that. Like, they were my Bible, like, just find all this fascinating information. Yeah, I love that element. And there's an element to it as well, as because there is like a significant amount of time that passes in the film. So you really get to experience sort of Owen's life in particular over a long period of time. And there's sort of a moment where he like revisits the show and it just isn't what he remembers, basically. And I thought that was really interesting, in the sense that, yeah, I've gone back and watched things that I loved when I was younger, and they're just not what you remember sometimes. Like, they're often just a lot more cheesy and juvenile, and they just don't have the same kind of, yeah, all-conquering obsessive nature that you had when you were younger. I thought that was just another sort of really interesting element that, I don't know, it's something that other filmmakers just haven't really spoken to yet. Like, it's just a very common experience for sort of people our age that just isn't really being explored by anyone else. And that's sort of reflected in some interesting casting as well, in the sense that you have like Amber Benson, who obviously played Tara in Buffy, plays a small character in this as well. There's also a very interesting bit of casting in that Fred Durst, the Limp Bizkit frontman, plays Owen's father. Very small role, but I actually thought he was pretty decent, like pretty convincing as like a sort of typically masculine father figure. I'm very curious how that bit of casting came about, and I wonder if Fred will be appearing in more films in the future.
I actually didn't even realize it was him until afterwards.
It's just like, it's just sort of another 90s noughties throwback, isn't it? Like, it just connects you to that era just intrinsically, just from the fact that, yeah, it's this person who was such like a towering figure during that time. Yeah, just a sort of fascinating blend of sort of cultures and eras.
Yeah, so a very, very interesting film. And if you fancy checking it out, that is I Saw the TV Glow, which is in cinemas from Friday. And now for the final feature film of the week, it's time for a complete change of pace with this.
Kaç yıldır oradasın?
Bu dördüncü yılım.
Tayin zamanı gelmiş.
Yani geldiğim ilk dakikadan beri aklımda sadece gitmek var.
Hem akıllı kız sonra bayağı, kafası da çalışıyor. Bak.
Madem bu kadar iyi, sen niye şey yapmıyorsun?
Ya ben gidiyorum oğlum buradan ya, Allah Allah.
This is About Dry Grasses, which I know you haven't seen, John, so I'll set this one up. It's the latest film from Turkish filmmaker Nuri Bilge Ceylan, who perhaps best known for Once Upon a Time in Anatolia. He's also done films Winter Sleep, and he also did The Wild Pear Tree, which I haven't seen, but I know Jordan rates as one of his least favourite films he's ever seen at a festival. we're in proper art house territory here, and he's a very distinctive filmmaker in that the types of films he makes, they're always very long. This film is 198 minutes, so it's a big time investment, and they very much move, like, slow burn is the polite way of saying it, like sort of very, very measured in their pace, and they don't rush. They're very much about, you know, kind of human stories and social interactions and things like that. And so to be completely honest, this is one of those films that I would describe simply as, on the surface, a hard sell, because even the title sounds quite boring, just about dry grasses. And you have to wait till right near the end to realise what that's referring to. And after a while, I was like, are they even going to tell us what these dry grasses are? So it's long, it's foreign language, which obviously I know can be, like, I've never been bothered by subtitles, but I do realise it's off-putting for some people. And it's, yeah, sounds boring. But basically, you know, I actually did quite enjoy this film. To try and sum up the story, basically, we're in eastern Anatolia in quite a remote village. It's very snowy for the most part. They have quite extreme seasons. So we're in winter. It's extreme snow. You do get some stunning kind of vistas. We have this guy, the main character, Samet. He's kind of returning from holidays and he's back to teach at this school. Just to sum up the story simply, Samet and another teacher called Keenan, a friend of his, they end up being accused of inappropriate behaviour by two young pupils. Then it unfolds from there, basically. That's a kind of simple way of putting it. And we see how it ripples outwards. We see how Samet kind of deals with that. And there's also a kind of a mutual sort of friend of theirs called Nurey, who's a teacher who lives fairly nearby. And she has lost a leg in a sort of terrorist incident. So she's kind of dealing with that, but they kind of get to know her, and there becomes a sort of love triangle between those three as well. So we just see how this all plays out, and it obviously happens in a very, very slow paced kind of way. But on the whole, I actually did find it quite gripping, really, considering it asks you to invest for a lot of time. And like I say, it's very measured. There's not really much in the way of, you know, kind of explosive scenes and things like that. But yeah, there is something gripping about the interaction of these characters. And it is one of those situations, partly because of the length, partly because of this remote, very snowy setting, and that just a little kind of daily details and rituals and routines you get to glimpse. It really does feel like it's one of those films that immerses you into another world, which is one of the things I obviously like about films and going to the cinema, is that chance to be transported to a different world. And you very much get that here. To be honest, I didn't always get everything that was going on. I didn't understand every social interaction. There's various people he meets up with and hangs out with at certain points. And I didn't always fully understand who they were, or, you know, why he was meeting them. But on the most part, you follow this story about the school and this, you know, like I say, I call it a love triangle between these three people. And I did find it interesting, engrossing. It's very much, you know, you obviously really have to be in the mood for it, as you can well imagine. But it's, yeah, I enjoyed getting absorbed into it. And it's also interesting because, again, I call him the main character, really, Samet. He's actually a really quite unpleasant guy, I thought. So I found that, like, interesting, because in some ways, I mean, of course you just don't have to, like, root for the protagonist in every film by any means. And it makes it interesting to have a film where you're dealing with someone who's sort of loathsome, really, I found him. And it's interesting just how it all plays out. And there's certain degrees of ambiguity throughout the whole film, and kind of themes on who you can trust and what to believe and things like that. And so you never kind of truly know for sure what happened between them and the children. And he doesn't behave very nicely afterwards, in the sense that, like, he really takes it out on all the children, and the girl who's kind of accused him, he doesn't treat very nicely. Yeah, there's interesting stuff going on there. And it also, it's very strange here, and this really surprised me, and this sort of, again, if your energy is kind of flagging when you're sort of reaching, when you're approaching the 3-hour mark, there was a very, very strange moment that I won't go into exactly what it was, but a strange moment that almost puts it of a weird kind of connected piece with Deadpool and Wolverine. And and I saw the TV glow. Just a strange, unexpected sort of, you know, level you could add there that was odd, but it kind of took me out the moment. But it was kind of interesting, kind of it stayed with me a bit. And again, not being funny, it kind of dragged me back into it, sort of, you know, kind of late on in the film. But overall, I actually liked it. So I didn't truly love it, I couldn't say, but I did enjoy being immersed in its environment.
Yeah, annoyingly, you've sort of sold me on that when I swore off ever watching a Nuri Bilge Ceylan film ever again after my horrendous experience with The Wild Pear at Cannes, which, yes, was the most boring film I've ever seen at a festival. Just not for me. I'm just not on his wavelength, I don't think. But this sounds pretty interesting, actually.
Once upon a time in Anatolia, that was like, again, I could kind of appreciate it without loving it. It feels similar, feels like it's very much in his wheelhouse, where you're seeing all these different, parts of this kind of society and how they deal with a particular incident and how it kind of ripples outwards. But yeah, I did enjoy it. I thought the main central performances were really good here as well. Yeah, I would say this is a good film, but again, you kind of know if you're going to be in the mood for this or Deadpool and Wolverine this week, I think.
Ultimate counter programming, really, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean,
Like, do you choose
100%,
this or
yeah.
do you choose Deadpool?
And I saw the TV glow as well, really. I think they really have come out with, yeah, counter programming in just the truest sense, haven't they? In terms of if you do fancy something different to that. So you can't kind of complain about superheroes dominating cinema too much if you aren't, don't fancy checking out either this or I saw the TV glow. And I'd say as well, this one, I would say it does actually benefit from the big screen as well, even though it's obviously you have that time investment that you've got to consider. But again, for that full immersion, for the full, like, not wanting to risk, like, because it is so slow paced at home, you would run the risk of, reaching for your phone, I think, at points. But it does reward giving yourself over to it and, putting the time in, really. So if you do fancy checking that out, that is About Dry Grasses, which is in cinemas from Friday. And we're just going to finish now by quickly looking at a history rewriting TV show with a big movie connection.
You're stuck in the past, Kevin.
You got to stop it with all these Vikings and the ancient geeks.
Freaks.
As well.
Mom, my wardrobe's moving.
Whoa!
So that is Time Bandits, which is the new Apple TV Plus series adapted from the film by Terry Gilliam. And this is created by Jermaine Clement, Ian Morris, and Taika Waititi. So do you want to briefly set it up for us, Jordan?
I mean, if you know the original Terry Gilliam film, obviously co-written by the great Michael Palin, you'll know pretty much what to expect from the story here. The most important new ingredient, though, is probably Taika Waititi, in the sense that if you know any of his work, you'll immediately recognize that his fingerprints are all over this because, not only did he co-create it, co-wrote many episodes, he actually directs at least the first two episodes that I know of. So yeah, very much is a sort of Waititian tone throughout the whole thing. That sort of deadpan, wry sense of humor, slight irreverent, off-kilter, all that kind of stuff that he's very much known for. So yeah, if you've seen the 1981 original, you'll know that it's about a history-obsessed boy called Kevin Haddock here. He goes on misadventures with a group of time-traveling bandits. Here they're led by Lisa Kudrow's Penelope. Lovely to see Lisa Kudrow in another series. I don't think I'd actually seen her in anything since Friends, which is must be nuts. Like, she has been in things, but I just don't think I've watched any of them. So yeah, really nice to see her back. She's very, very funny, very good value. Bandits have stolen a map belonging to the Supreme Being, a map of sort of portals that allow them to travel through time and space to various points in history where they intend to just steal as much as they can. The sole motivation for them, it seems. But it's a map that Jermaine Clement, who also stars as pure evil, he will stop at nothing to get his hands on. So it's a race away from pure evil's minions and towards the shiniest objects that they can find throughout history. I love the original film, and one of the sort of joys of the original is not only just popping up in all these different eras, but just seeing who they've got to play all these huge figures throughout history. And you don't get much of that in the first two episodes. In the first two episodes, you get to go to Stonehenge, a 19th century pirate ship, Chinese pirate ship, and to sort of Mayan civilization, essentially. But you don't get any sort of big name cameos in the first two episodes. But you do just get a very fun sort of history tour. And the joy of it for me was just seeing Kevin interact with the group. He's like in the original, he's a sort of history buff who just knows everything about history and can't help but spout off little facts about where he is and tell people about what's going to happen. And the bandits just aren't impressed by him at all. They just found him a big annoyance, basically, and they just try to lose him at every opportunity that they can. The young actor who plays Kevin, who's real name is actually Kal-El, which
his parents must be Superman fans, mustn't they?
They've got to be, yeah. Be a very strange coincidence if they weren't. He is great, and he actually reminded me of a kind of young Garth Marenghi. Like, he just had like exactly the same intonation of voice and delivery, which I found very amusing. I found him a very sort of heartwarming presence at the center of the show. And it's all like it's very well realized. Like, they've clearly spent like quite a bit of money on this. It has that sort of Doctor Who feel, in the sense that they haven't gone for like strict realism as they're traveling through time. Everything looks like a little bit stagey, but sort of deliberately so, in the sense that it's like you're traveling through a sort of storybook version of history. And then you just get like very fun deadpan interactions with characters. Like, when they go to Stonehenge, they sort of speak to the main guy who's erecting Stonehenge, and Kevin's asking him all these questions, and he's like, just thought it'd be good here, like, place to put a gift shop, isn't it?
Like, he's basically like a classic builder as well, isn't it?
Yeah, kind exactly. Of like they sort
of riff on those sort of types that you would know.
So it's very, even though it is from Taika, and you can very much sense his fingerprints on it, it does just have that British Python-esque sense of humor running through it, which I assume comes a lot from Ian Morris, but then also it's sort of blended with Taika's style in a way that I found pretty fun. You know, I don't think it's going to blow anyone away. It's very much just doing what Time Bandits did, just updating it. And it is a concept that does make sense as a series, because you do just have, you can just take Doctor Who-esque adventures off to these different lands each week. I'm sort of on board for it, I think, even though it doesn't feel 100% essential. I'm enjoying it enough that I'm willing to keep going with it.
Yeah, I must say, because it's sort of come almost out of nowhere, it feels like, because obviously we've known it's been in the works for a while. But it feels like it didn't have a massive sort of pre-release promo. Again, if you forgive the hard sell, there is a nice little interview with Taika and Jermaine in the new issue of Total Film, which is out now. But that obviously gave me a little bit of background to the series. And they say in there that they kind of cast Kevin. They cast Kal-El as Kevin and then built the rest of the sort of family around him. I can totally see why they did that. And sometimes they say that, but he really is great. I think the kid, he's just genuinely very funny as a child actor. But yeah, obviously I didn't know a huge amount about it, so I kind of started it not having really seen anything of it. And I have seen the Terry Gilliam film, but I've only seen it once and quite a while ago. So it's not a film I'm like, you know, have huge sort of fond memories of in that sense. But like you say, a very enjoyable idea. And I just found it very funny. And I have to caveat that I'm just very, very much on Jermaine Clement and Taika Waititi's wavelengths. And I mentioned Harold and the Purple Crayon earlier, and Jermaine Clement is in that as well. It's this sort of the kind of villainous type character. So make of that what you will. If I you know, can you infer if I enjoyed him in that or not? Anyway, I'm very much on Taika Waititi's humor wavelength. I know some people find it divisive, and some people just don't like that the nature of that comedy, where they just kind of, it feels a bit improvised, versus they're just standing around saying silly stuff and having these sort of, you know, funny minor interactions back and forth. But it very much tickles me, so I've just found it very funny. I've only seen the first episode at this point. We had the first couple of episodes ready to review, because then they're dropping more weekly, so only the first two are sort of, you know, free to review at the moment. But yes, yeah, so I've only actually seen the first, but I really enjoyed it, and I thought, yeah, like, surprising. I was like, yeah, I'm gonna stick with this. Like you say, the production values I thought were really actually pretty damn good, and I liked sort of pure evils, like, you know, sort of dark lair where he lived. And again, there's just some very classic silly Waititi and Clement type jokes around that, around sort of misheard things and that kind of thing. And the one sort of negative I thought about the first episode, and I don't know how this will continue during the series and even into what if the second episode hints what way it's going to go, but they kind of visit two different places and eras in the first episode, and I felt that they could have just done one. Basically, I felt the episodes just could have been a bit shorter, because that first episode was a good 40, you know, near 50 minutes I think it was, and I felt like it just, perhaps just the tone of the comedy and the fact that they visited two places, I felt it could have just perhaps been split into two episodes, and maybe this would have worked well as a 22 minute comedy series instead. But I mean, obviously you're kind of setting up the premise in that first episode as well. That, again, that's a bit of a minor grumble, because like I say, I did still really actually enjoy it and will carry on. But I feel like that was a small gripe I had with it.
Yeah, They took your suggestion on board because the second episode, they just visit one place. So
nice.
I can't speak to future episodes because I've only seen the first two that are currently available to watch on Apple TV Plus. But yeah, it felt like the second episode, to your point, felt like the right sort of length and the right amount of material to sort of be tackling in a single episode. I guess the only thing I'm slightly concerned about, if you can say that, is that I just wonder if it's going to feel like a tiny bit repetitive as you go along, in the sense that they're not doing anything other than turning up to these places and trying to steal stuff. And they're obviously like completely in-depth thieves. So they're not like going on any like great heist or anything. They're just turning up to places and saying, where do you keep your expensive stuff? And then going over there. That's basically it. So yeah, I assume they've come up with like creative ways to keep it interesting, but feels like there's a slightly limited lifespan in terms of what they can do as a show, and there's a reason why it worked well as a movie and not as a series originally, but we'll see how it goes. I'm intrigued to see if they can keep it up. And yeah, you just can't like underestimate a show that just is like funny. Like it just does keep you laughing like throughout. Like I watch plenty of things which are quote unquote comedies, which give me like a sort of, you laugh on the inside basically, but you're not sort of laughing outside, whereas with this I did feel like I was sort of chuckling out loud like every so often, which is actually no easy feat.
Yes, I was really surprised at how enjoyable this actually was. I was also surprised, this is a very random observation, but I was surprised at the end the credit comes up as based in part on characters created by Terry Gilliam and Michael Palin, which just felt like an odd like credit to me. I feel like I've never heard it phrased in that way before. But anyway, that's just a random aside. But if you do fancy checking that out, that is Time Bandits, and that has started streaming on Apple TV Plus now, with new episodes dropping weekly. So Jordan, what would you say is your film of the week this week?
Deadpool and Wolverine, The Sleep feels like an essential cinema trip, just so you don't have all the big cameos spoiled. And also it is a very, very entertaining time at the movies. But just in terms of the film that I think is going to stick with me the longest, like I saw The TV Glow, hands down.
Yeah, same for me. I enjoyed all the films this week, but that is definitely the one that will kind of stick with me longer, so that I will revisit again most in the future. So, and yeah, we're approaching the end of the podcast now. Just a reminder that our Alien Romulus issue is out now, so you can find it in shops or pick it up digitally. And if you take out a subscription, you'll get instant digital access to the Alien Romulus issue, so you can start reading that straight away before your first print copy arrives. So if you don't subscribe already, please consider joining us. And if you fancy signing up, there will be a subscription link in the podcast notes. And talking of subscribing, if you like this podcast, please do subscribe and review on your podcast app of choice. And remember, you can always contact us on our social media channels or email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, just time for a quick question. And related to Deadpool and Wolverine, the question this week is, what is your favourite Fox Marvel film?
Tricky question. This is probably something we can get into, but I thought about sort of four sort of very clear favorites in terms of like fourth at the top of the list. But I guess if I had to pick one, I would probably go with Logan, just because it just feels like the most accomplished and distinct piece of work. And, you know, the fact it was Hugh's supposed swan song as the character at the time anyway, it just felt like it had so much more impact and just felt completely different to any other superhero movie at the time. And I loved Daphne Keene as X-23, and I just thought Hugh brought just so much to that character. The fact it was an aged version of that character just worked so well. Some things I don't love about it, I don't love the whole Wolverine clone element. Like that just felt like a sort of conceit too far to me, in terms of, you know, a character hating on themselves. But apart from that, yeah, tremendous piece of work with just one of the all-time great trailers as well. Like every so often I'll just watch that trailer with the Nine Inch Nails cover of Johnny Cash's Hurt, and it just always makes my skin tingle. Such a good trailer, and a film that lived up to it. Yeah, what's yours, Matt?
Yeah, this is a tough one for me, because the one point I sort of wanted to get across, and I thought you were going to go for this, and so then I was going to then go for Logan, predicting that you would have gone for this, but I thought you were going to have gone for X2.
Yeah, it is it's so good. Yeah.
Because whilst I do obviously rate that film, it's one of those, a bit like Spider-Man 2 for me, where I do rate it highly and obviously think it's a good film. I wouldn't in any way slag it off or say it's bad, but I don't love them as much as other people seem to, and don't think they necessarily were so much better than the films that came before them, you know, as terms of them always being referred to among the great sequels. So I probably would choose X-Men as my favorite of them, just because I always just slightly preferred that to X2. And partly, again, as I sort of mentioned earlier, but just because I just love Hugh Jackman as Wolverine. So, and I love that introduction to him in this. And that was, you know, obviously the first time any of us had seen him as that character. And I don't know why, I never felt that, like, until arguably perhaps until Logan, I never felt like the films quite served him as well as this first one did, where he was, you know, that the way he was part of that ensemble and the way he was brought in. I don't know, I just thought he worked best in this film, and I just really liked it.
There's always something thrilling about being introduced to the world and the characters as well for the first time, and just that dawning realization that they've got it right. Like, oh my God, they're actually doing it. Like, this isn't like cheesy and naff like so many superhero movies have been up to that point. So the approach just really worked. But yeah, for me, it would be X-Men 2 over X-Men. Just the better sort of set pieces in a way. Like the Nightcrawler attack at the start is just so well staged, really well done. And then just to broadly
It's the slicker kind of film, definitely, as well. Like the first one has sort of slightly chintzy sort of elements to it, where it feels finding
their
cheap
footing. Definitely, it feels like X2 was the one where they were just very confident in what they were doing, and they had all the resources to do it. Yeah, but there are like a lot of films that I do like in the Fox universe. I'm an enjoyer of the Daredevil director's cut, a rare director's cut that does like substantially improve the film. Obviously, X-Men First Class, like, that is very near the top of the list for me.
Just
a very confident film, tremendous like recasting of those characters. The Magneto stuff just works so well in that film, tying it to his past in Auschwitz and all that kind of stuff in the concentration camp. Days of Future Past, I don't love as much as some people seem to, but as the first big sort of time traveling superhero film, I thought it did work very well. And the other one that I do quite enjoy is Deadpool, the first one.
Up there as well.
It's just such an underdog movie, wasn't it? Like, you just really got the sense that they were just outsiders doing something quite different, and just felt like such a breath of fresh air at the time, which is part of the joke in Deadpool and Wolverine, that it's now become corporatized in a way to be Deadpool, to make these fourth wall gags. Like, that's all very funny, but the first Deadpool just felt like the most pure in terms of its gonzo do anything nature. So I'll always have a soft spot for Deadpool.
Of all the kind of recent superhero movies, I think Deadpool does kind of work. Obviously, there's all the jokes and everything, but it works as a standalone. It's like a nice sort of neat origin story, which is always kind of satisfying when done well. And like you say, it was just such a breath of fresh air at that time. And nice that it was one of those things that, obviously, the sort of portrayal of Wade went badly wrong in X-Men Origins Wolverine. So it was nice they actually, you know, did manage to claw things back, if you will, from there and actually do the character justice, and actually got time to, do it again, got that chance. Because, won't go into it now, but it was just totally baffling what they did with the character in
in retrospect,
X-Men Origins. It just seems like such a weird, especially for obviously what's gone on to be one of their most lucrative characters. It's just such bizarre treatment, but very, very odd for like an actor to have another go at just doing the right version of the character.
Very strange. Just looking at the list of Fox Marvel films as well, it puts into perspective just how low their hit rate was. it really wasn't a sort of successful endeavor in the whole. There's just a lot of quite poor films.
I mean,
occasionally bolstered by, you know, an X2 or a Deadpool or a Logan.
Yeah, and obviously Fantastic Four is going to be the next thing to get the MCU treatment, and see if that can finally do justice to the beloved comic characters.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, that's all we've got time for now, and we will be skipping another week next week, so there'll be no podcast next week, but Jordan will be back the week after that. So thanks very much for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
Bye.